communicating only to their small circle. Such art remains cornered and powerless. Finally, since power is a human creation, it is inevitably increased by contact with other people. Instead of falling into the fortress mentality, view the world in the following manner. It is like a vast Versailles, with every room communicating with another. You need to be permeable, able to float in and out of different circles and mix with different types. That kind of mobility and social contact will protect you from plotters, who will be unable to keep secrets from you and from your enemies, who will be unable to isolate you from your allies. Always on the move, you mix and mingle in the rooms of the palace, never sitting or settling in one place. No hunter can fix his aim on such a swift-moving creature. Reversal. It is hardly ever right and propitious to choose isolation. Without keeping an ear on what is happening in the streets, you will be unable to protect yourself. About the only thing that constant human contact cannot facilitate is thought. The weight of society's pressure to conform and the lack of distance from other people can make it impossible to think clearly about what is going on around you. As a temporary recourse, then, isolation can't help you to gain perspective. Many a serious thinker has been produced in prisons, where we have nothing to do but think. Machiavelli could write The Prince only once he found himself in exile and isolated on a farm far from the political intrigues of Florence. The danger is, however, that this kind of isolation will sire all kinds of strange and perverted ideas. You may gain perspective on the larger picture, but you lose a sense of your own smallness and limitations. Also, the more isolated you are, the harder it is to break out of your isolation when you choose to. It sinks you deeper into its quicksand without your noticing. If you need time to think, then choose isolation only as a last resort, and only in small doses. Be careful to keep your way back into society open. Here is a further reflection on this law. From The Mask of the Red Death by Edgar Allan Poe. The Red Death had long devastated the country. No pestilence had ever been so fatal or so hideous. Blood was its avatar and its seal, the redness and horror of blood. There were sharp pains and sudden dizziness, and then profuse bleeding at the pores with dissolution. And the whole seizure, progress, and termination of the disease were the incidents of half an hour. But the Prince Prospero was happy and dauntless and sagacious. When his dominions were half depopulated, he summoned to his presence 1,000 hale and light-hearted friends from among the knights and dames of his court. And with these, he retired to the deep seclusion of one of his castellated abbeys. This was an extensive and magnificent structure, the creation of the prince's own eccentric yet august taste. A strong and lofty wall girdled it in. This wall had gates of iron. The courtiers, having entered, brought furnaces and massy hammers and welded the bolts. They resolved to leave means neither of ingress nor egress to the sudden impulses of despair or of frenzy from within. The abbey was amply provisioned. With such precautions, the courtiers might bid defiance to contagion. The external world could take care of itself. In the meantime, it was folly to grieve or to think. The prince had provided all the appliances of pleasure. There were buffoons. There were improvisatori. There were ballet dancers. There were musicians. There was beauty. There was wine. All these and security were within. Without was the Red Death. It was toward the close of the 5th or 6th month of his seclusion, and while the pestilence raged most furiously abroad, that the Prince Prospero entertained his 1,000 friends at a masked ball of the most unusual magnificence. It was a voluptuous scene, that masquerade, and the revel went whirlingly on, until at length there commenced the sounding of midnight upon the clock. And thus, too, it happened, perhaps, that before the last echoes of the last chime had utterly sunk into silence, there were many individuals in the crowd who had found leisure to become aware of the presence of a masked figure, which had arrested the attention of no single individual before. The figure was tall and gaunt, and shrouded from head to foot in the habiliments of the grave. The mask which concealed the visage was made so nearly to resemble the countenance of a stiffened corpse that the closest scrutiny must have had difficulty in detecting the cheat. And yet all this might have been endured, if not approved, by the mad revelers around. But the mummer had gone so far as to assume the type of the Red Death. His vesture was dabbled in blood, and his broad brow, with all the features of the face, was sprinkled with a scarlet horror. A throng of the revelers at once threw themselves into the black apartment and seized the mummer, whose tall figure stood erect and motionless within the shadow of the ebony clock, gasped in unutterable horror at finding the grave cerements and corpse-like mask, which they handled with so violent a rudeness, untenanted by any tangible form. And now was acknowledged the presence of the Red Death. He had come like a thief in the night, and one by one dropped the revelers in the blood-bedewed halls of their revel, and died each in the despairing posture of his fall. And the life of the ebony clock went out with that of the last of the gay, and the flames of the tripods expired, and darkness and decay and the Red Death held illimitable dominion over all. The 19th Law. Know who you're dealing with. Do not offend the wrong person. Judgment. There are many different kinds of people in the world, and you can never assume that everyone will react to your strategies in the same way. Deceive or outmaneuver some people, and they will spend the rest of their lives seeking revenge. They are wolves in lamb's clothing. Choose your victims and opponents carefully, then. Never offend or deceive the wrong person. Opponents, suckers, and victims. Preliminary typology. In your rise to power, you will come across many breeds of opponent, sucker, and victim. The highest form of the art of power is the ability to distinguish the wolves from the lambs, the foxes from the hares, the hawks from the vultures. If you make this distinction well, you will succeed without needing to coerce anyone too much. But if you deal blindly with whomever crosses your path, you will have a life of constant sorrow, if you even live that long. Being able to recognize types of people and to act accordingly is critical. The following are the 5 most dangerous and difficult types of mark in the jungle, as identified by artists, con and otherwise, of the past. The arrogant and proud man. Although he may initially disguise it, this man's touchy pride makes him very dangerous. Any perceived slight will lead to a vengeance of overwhelming violence. You may say to yourself, "But I only said such and such at a party where everyone was drunk." It doesn't matter. There is no sanity behind his overreaction, so don't waste your time trying to figure him out. If at any point in your dealings with a person you sense an oversensitive and overacting pride, flee. Whatever you are hoping for from him isn't worth it. The hopelessly insecure man. This man is related to the proud and arrogant type, but is less violent and harder to spot. His ego is fragile, his sense of self insecure. And if he feels himself deceived or attacked, the hurt will simmer. He will attack you in bites that will take forever to get big enough for you to notice. If you find you have deceived or harmed such a man, disappear for a long time. Do not stay around him, or he will nibble you to death. Mr. Suspicion. Another variant on the breeds above, this is a future Joe Stalin. He sees what he wants to see, usually the worst in other people, and imagines that everyone is after him. Mr. Suspicion is in fact the least dangerous of the three. Genuinely unbalanced, he is easy to deceive, just as Stalin himself was constantly deceived. Play on his suspicious nature, to get him to turn against other people. But if you do become the target of his suspicions, watch out. The serpent with a long memory. If hurt or deceived, this man will show no anger on the surface. He will calculate and wait. Then, when he is in a position to turn the tables, he will exact a revenge marked by a cold-blooded shrewdness. Recognize this man by his calculation and cunning in the different areas of his life. He is usually cold and unaffectionate. Be doubly careful of this snake, and if you have somehow injured him, either crush him completely or get him out of your sight. The plain, unassuming, and often unintelligent man. Ah, your ears prick up when you find such a tempting victim. But this man is a lot harder to deceive than you imagine. Falling for a ruse often takes intelligence and imagination, a sense of the possible rewards. The blunt man will not take the bait because he doesn't recognize it. He is that unaware. The danger with this man is not that he will harm you or seek revenge, but merely that he will waste your time, energy, resources, and even your sanity in trying to deceive him. Have a test ready for a mark, a joke, a story. If his reaction is utterly literal, this is the type you're dealing with. Continue at your own risk. Transgressions of the law. Transgression number one. In the early part of the 13th century, Muhammad, the Shah of Khwarizm, managed after many wars to forge a huge empire, extending west to present-day Turkey and south to Afghanistan. The empire's center was the great Asian capital of Samarkand. The Shah had a powerful, well-trained army and could mobilize 200,000 warriors within days. In 1219, Muhammad received an embassy from a new tribal leader to the east, Genghis Khan. The embassy included all sorts of gifts to the great Muhammad, representing the finest goods from Khan's small but growing Mongol empire. Genghis Khan wanted to reopen the Silk Route to Europe and offered to share it with Muhammad while promising peace between the two empires. Muhammad did not know this upstart from the east, who it seemed to him was extremely arrogant to try to talk as an equal to one so clearly his superior. He ignored Khan's offer. Khan tried again. This time he sent a caravan of 100 camels filled with the rarest articles he had plundered from China. Before the caravan reached Muhammad, however, Inalchuk, the governor of a region bordering on Samarkand, seized it for himself and executed its leaders. Genghis Khan was sure that this was a mistake, that Inalchuk had acted without Muhammad's approval. He sent yet another mission to Muhammad, reiterating his offer and asking that the governor be punished. This time Muhammad himself had one of the ambassadors beheaded and sent the other two back with shaved heads, a horrifying insult in the Mongol code of honor. Khan sent a message to the Shah. "You have chosen war. What will happen. And what it is to be, we know not. Only God knows." Mobilizing his forces, in 1220 he attacked Inalchik's province, where he seized the capital, captured the governor, and ordered him executed by having molten silver poured into his eyes and ears. Over the next year, Khan led a series of guerrilla-like campaigns against the Shah's much larger army. His method was totally novel for the time. His soldiers could move very fast on horseback and had mastered the art of firing the bow and arrow while mounted. The speed and flexibility of his forces allowed him to deceive Muhammad as to his intentions and the directions of his movements. Eventually, he managed first to surround Samarkand, then to seize it. Muhammad fled, and a year later died, his vast empire broken and destroyed. Genghis Khan was sole master of Samarkand, the Silk Route, and most of northern Asia. Interpretation. Never assume that the person you are dealing with is weaker or less important than you are. Some men are slow to take offense, which may make you misjudge the thickness of their skin and fail to worry about insulting them. But should you offend their honor and their pride, they will overwhelm you with a violence that seems sudden and extreme, given their slowness to anger. If you want to turn people down, it is best to do so politely and respectfully, even if you feel their request is impudent or their offer ridiculous. Never reject them with an insult until you know them better. You may be dealing with a Genghis Khan. Transgression number two. In the late 1910s, some of the best swindlers in America formed a con artist ring based in Denver, Colorado. In the winter months, they would spread across the southern states, plying their trade. In 1920, Joe Fury, the leader of the ring, was working his way through Texas, making hundreds of thousands of dollars with classic con games. In Fort Worth, he met a sucker named J. Frank Norfleet, a cattleman who owned a large ranch. Norfleet fell for the con. Convinced of the riches to come, he emptied his bank account of $45,000 and handed it over to Fury and his Confederates. A few days later, they gave him his millions, which turned out to be a few good dollars wrapped around a packet of newspaper clippings. Fury and his men had worked such cons 100 times before, and the sucker was usually so embarrassed by his gullibility that he quietly learned his lesson and accepted the loss. But Norfleet was not like other suckers. He went to the police, who told him there was little they could do. "Then I'll go after those people myself," Norfleet told the detectives. "I'll get them, too, if it takes the rest of my life." His wife took over the ranch as Norfleet scoured the country, looking for others who had been fleeced in the same game. One such sucker came forward, and the two men identified one of the con artists in San Francisco and managed to get him locked up. The man committed suicide rather than face a long term in prison. Norfleet kept going. He tracked down another of the con artists in Montana, roped him like a calf, and dragged him through the muddy streets to the town jail. He traveled not only across the country, but to England, Canada, and Mexico in search of Joe Fury, and also of Fury's right-hand man, W.B. Spencer. Finding Spencer in Montreal, Norfleet chased him through the streets. Spencer escaped, but the rancher stayed on his trail and caught up with him in Salt Lake City. Preferring the mercy of the law to Norfleet's wrath, Spencer turned himself in. Norfleet found Fury in Jacksonville, Florida, and personally hauled him off to face justice in Texas. But he wouldn't stop there. He continued on to Denver, determined to break up the entire ring. Spending not only large sums of money, but another year of his life in the pursuit, he managed to put all of the con ring's leaders behind bars. Even some he didn't catch had grown so terrified of him that they, too, turned themselves in. After 5 years of hunting, Norfleet had single-handedly destroyed the country's largest confederation of con artists. The effort bankrupted him and ruined his marriage, but he died a satisfied man. Interpretation. Most men accept the humiliation of being conned with a sense of resignation. They learn their lesson, recognizing that there is no such thing as a free lunch and that they usually have been brought down by their own greed for easy money. Some, however, refuse to take their medicine. Instead of reflecting on their own gullibility and avarice, they see themselves as totally innocent victims. Men like this may seem to be crusaders for justice and honesty, but they are actually immoderately insecure. Being fooled, being conned, has activated their self-doubt, and they are desperate to repair the damage. Were the mortgage on Norfleet's ranch, the collapse of his marriage, and the years of borrowing money and living in cheap hotels worth his revenge over his embarrassment at being fleeced? To the Norfleets of the world, overcoming their embarrassment is worth any price. All people have insecurities, and often the best way to deceive a sucker is to play upon his insecurities. But in the realm of power, everything is a question of degree, and the person who is decidedly more insecure than the average mortal presents great dangers. Be warned, if you practice deception or trickery of any sort, study your mark well. Some people's insecurity and ego fragility cannot tolerate the slightest offense. To see if you are dealing with such a type, test them first. Make, say, a mild joke at their expense. A confident person will laugh. An overly insecure one will react as if personally insulted. If you suspect you are dealing with this type, find another victim. Transgression number 3. In the 5th century BC, Chun Ru, the prince of Qin in present-day China, had been forced into exile. He lived modestly, even sometimes in poverty, waiting for the time when he could return home and resume his princely life. Once he was passing through the state of Chung, where the ruler, not knowing who he was, treated him rudely. The ruler's minister, Xu Chan, saw this and said, "This man is a worthy prince. May your highness treat him with great courtesy, and thereby place him under an obligation." The ruler, able to see only the prince's lowly station, ignored this advice and insulted the prince again. Shuchan again warned his master, saying, "If your highness cannot treat Shung'e with courtesy, you should put him to death to avoid calamity in the future." The ruler only scoffed. Years later, the prince was finally able to return home. His circumstances greatly changed. He did not forget who had been kind to him and who had been insolent during his years of poverty. Least of all did he forget his treatment at the hands of the ruler of Chung. At his first opportunity, he assembled a vast army and marched on Chung, taking 8 cities, destroying the kingdom, and sending the ruler into an exile of his own. Interpretation. You can never be sure who you're dealing with. A man who is of little importance and means today can be a person of power tomorrow. We forget a lot in our lives, but we rarely forget an insult. How was the ruler of Chung to know that Prince Chung'e was an ambitious, calculating, cunning type, a serpent with a long memory? There was really no way for him to know, you may say. But since there was no way, it would have been better not to tempt the fates by finding out. There is nothing to be gained by insulting a person unnecessarily. Swallow the impulse to offend, even if the other person seems weak. The satisfaction is meager compared to the danger that someday he or she will be in a position to hurt you. Transgression number 4. The year of 1920 had been a particularly bad one for American art dealers. Big buyers, the robber baron generation of the previous century, were getting to an age where they were dying off like flies, and no new millionaires had emerged to take their place. Things were so bad that a number of the major dealers decided to pool their resources, an unheard-of event, since art dealers usually get along like cats and dogs. Joseph Duveen, art dealer to the richest tycoons of America, was suffering more than the others that year, so he decided to go along with this alliance. The group now consisted of the 5 biggest dealers in the country. Looking around for a new client, they decided that their last best hope was Henry Ford, then the wealthiest man in America. Ford had yet to venture into the art market, and he was such a big target that it made sense for them to work together. The dealers decided to assemble a list, the 100 greatest paintings in the world, all of which they happened to have in stock, and to offer the lot of them to Ford. With one purchase, he could make himself the world's greatest collector. The consortium worked for weeks to produce a magnificent object, a 3-volume set of books containing beautiful reproductions of the paintings, as well as scholarly texts accompanying each picture. Next, they made a personal visit to Ford at his home in Dearborn, Michigan. There, they were surprised by the simplicity of his house. Mr. Ford was obviously an extremely unaffected man. Ford received them in his study. Looking through the book, he expressed astonishment and delight. The excited dealers began imagining the millions of dollars that would shortly flow into their coffers. Finally, however, Ford looked up from the book and said, "Gentlemen, beautiful books like these, with beautiful colored pictures like these, must cost an awful lot." "But, Mr. Ford," exclaimed Duveen, "we don't expect you to buy these books. We got them up especially for you to show you the pictures. These books are a present to you." Ford seemed puzzled. "Gentlemen," he said, "it is extremely nice of you, but I really don't see how I can accept a beautiful, expensive present like this from strangers." Duveen explained to Ford that the reproductions in the books showed paintings that they hoped to sell him. Ford finally understood. "But, gentlemen," he exclaimed, "what would I want with the original pictures when the ones right here in these books are so beautiful?" Interpretation. Joseph Duveen prided himself on studying his victims and clients in advance, figuring out their weaknesses and the peculiarities of their tastes before he ever met them. He was driven by desperation to drop this tactic just once in his assault on Henry Ford. It took him months to recover from his misjudgment, both mentally and monetarily. Ford was the unassuming, plain man type who just isn't worth the bother. He was the incarnation of those literal-minded folk who do not possess enough imagination to be deceived. From then on, Duveen saved his energies for the Mellons and Morgans of the world, men crafty enough for him to entrap in his snares. Keys to power. The ability to measure people and to know who you're dealing with is the most important skill of all in gathering and conserving power. Without it, you are blind. Not only will you offend the wrong people, you will choose the wrong types to work on, and will think you are flattering people when you're actually insulting them. Before embarking on any move, take the measure of your mark or potential opponent. Otherwise, you will waste time and make mistakes. Study people's weaknesses, the chinks in their armor, their areas of both pride and insecurity. Know their ins and outs before you even decide whether or not to deal with them. Two final words of caution. First, in judging and measuring your opponent, never rely on your instincts. You will make the greatest mistakes of all if you rely on such inexact indicators. Nothing can substitute for gathering concrete knowledge. Study and spy on your opponent for however long it takes. This will pay off in the long run. Second, never trust appearances. Anyone with a serpent's heart can use a show of kindness to cloak it. A person who is blustery on the outside is often really a coward. Learn to see through appearances and their contradictions. Never trust the version that people give of themselves. It is utterly unreliable. Reversal. What possible good can come from ignorance about other people? Learn to tell the lions from the lambs or pay the price. Obey this law to its fullest extent. It has no reversal. Do not bother looking for one. Here are some further reflections on this law. From a Chan Buddhist classic. When you meet a swordsman, draw your sword. Do not recite poetry to one who is not a poet. From The Golden Dream, Seekers of El Dorado, by Walker Chapman. The Revenge of Lope de Aguirre. Lope de Aguirre's character is amply illustrated in an anecdote from the chronicle of Garcilaso de la Vega, who related that in 1548, Aguirre was a member of a platoon of soldiers escorting Indian slaves from the mines at Potosi, Bolivia, to a royal treasury depot. The Indians were illegally burdened with great quantities of silver, and a local official arrested Aguirre, sentencing him to receive 200 lashes in lieu of a fine for oppressing the Indians. The soldier Aguirre, having received a notification of the sentence, besought the alcalde that, instead of flogging him, he would put him to death, for that he was a gentleman by birth. All this had no effect on the alcalde, who ordered the executioner to bring a beast and execute the sentence. The executioner came to the prison and put Aguirre on the beast. The beast was driven on, and he received the lashes. When freed, Aguirre announced his intention of killing the official who had sentenced him, the alcalde Esquivel. Esquivel's term of office expired, and he fled to Lima, 320 leagues away. But within 15 days, Aguirre had tracked him there. The frightened judge journeyed to Quito, a trip of 400 leagues, and in 20 days Aguirre arrived. When Esquivel heard of his presence, according to Garcilaso, he made another journey of 500 leagues to Cusco. But in a few days, Aguirre also arrived, having traveled on foot and without shoes, saying that a whipped man has no business to ride a horse or to go where he would be seen by others. In this way, Aguirre followed his judge for 3 years and 4 months. Wearying of the pursuit, Esquivel remained at Cusco, a city so sternly governed that he felt he would be safe from Aguirre. He took a house near the cathedral and never ventured outdoors without a sword and a dagger. However, on a certain Monday at noon, Aguirre entered his house, and having walked all over it and having traversed a corridor, a saloon, a chamber, and an inner chamber where the judge kept his books, he at last found him asleep over one of his books and stabbed him to death. The murderer then went out. But when he came to the door of the house, he found that he had forgotten his hat, and had the temerity to return and fetch it, and then walk down the street. From a fable by Aesop, The Crow and the Sheep. A troublesome crow seated herself on the back of a sheep. The sheep, much against his will, carried her backward and forward for a long time, and at last said, "If you had treated a dog in this way, you would have had your deserts from his sharp teeth." To this the crow replied, "I despise the weak and yield to the strong. I know whom I may bully and whom I must flatter, and thus I hope to prolong my life to a good old age." The 20th Law. Do not commit to anyone. Judgment. It is the fool who always rushes to take sides. Do not commit to any side or cause but yourself. By maintaining your independence, you become the master of others, playing people against one another, making them pursue you. Part 1. Do not commit to anyone, but be courted by all. If you allow people to feel they possess you to any degree, you will lose all power over them. By not committing your affections, they will only try harder to win you over. Stay aloof, and you gain the power that comes from their attention and frustrated desire. Play the Virgin Queen. Give them hope, but never satisfaction. Observance of the Law. When Queen Elizabeth I ascended the throne of England in 1558, there was much to do about her finding a husband. The issue was debated in Parliament, and was a main topic of conversation among Englishmen of all classes. They often disagreed as to whom she should marry, but everyone thought she should marry as soon as possible, for a queen must have a king, and must bear heirs for the kingdom. The debates raged on for years. Meanwhile, the most handsome and eligible bachelors in the realm, Sir Robert Dudley, the Earl of Essex, Sir Walter Raleigh, vied for Elizabeth's hand. She didn't discourage them, but she seemed to be in no hurry, and her hints as to which man might be her favorite often contradicted each other. In 1566, Parliament sent a delegation to Elizabeth, urging her to marry before she was too old to bear children. She didn't argue, nor did she discourage the delegation, but she remained a virgin nonetheless. The delicate game that Elizabeth played with her suitors slowly made her the subject of innumerable sexual fantasies and the object of cultish worship. The court physician, Simon Forman, used his diary to describe his dreams of deflowering her. Painters represented her as Diana and other goddesses. The poet Edmund Spenser and others wrote eulogies to the Virgin Queen. She was referred to as the world's empress, that virtuous Virgo who rules the world and sets the stars in motion. In conversation with her, her many male suitors would employ bold sexual innuendo, a dare that Elizabeth didn't discourage. She did all she could to stir their interest and simultaneously keep them at bay. Throughout Europe, kings and princes knew that a marriage with Elizabeth would seal an alliance between England and any nation. The King of Spain wooed her, as did the Prince of Sweden and the Archduke of Austria. She politely refused them all. The great diplomatic issue of Elizabeth's day was posed by the revolt of the Flemish and Dutch lowlands, which were then possessions of Spain. Should England break its alliance with Spain and choose France as its main ally on the continent, thereby encouraging Flemish and Dutch independence? By 1570, it had come to seem that an alliance with France would be England's wisest course. France had two eligible men of noble blood, the Dukes of Anjou and Alençon, brothers of the French king. Would either of them marry Elizabeth? Both had advantages, and Elizabeth kept the hopes of both alive. The issue simmered for years. The Duke of Anjou made several visits to England, kissed Elizabeth in public, even called her by pet names. She appeared to requite his affections. Meanwhile, as she flirted with the two brothers, a treaty was signed that sealed peace between France and England. By 1582, Elizabeth thought she could break off the courtship. In the case of the Duke of Anjou in particular, she did so with great relief. For the sake of diplomacy, she had allowed herself to be courted by a man whose presence she couldn't stand, and whom she found physically repulsive. Once peace between France and England was secure, she dropped the unctuous Duke as politely as she could. By this time, Elizabeth was too old to bear children. She was accordingly able to live the rest of her life as she desired, and she died the Virgin Queen. She left no direct heir, but ruled through a period of incomparable peace and cultural fertility. Interpretation. Elizabeth had good reason not to marry. She had witnessed the mistakes of Mary, Queen of Scots, her cousin. Resisting the idea of being ruled by a woman, the Scots expected Mary to marry and marry wisely. To wed a foreigner would be unpopular. To favor any particular noble house would open up terrible rivalries. In the end, Mary chose Lord Darnley, a Catholic. In doing so, she incurred the wrath of Scotland's Protestants, and endless turmoil ensued. Elizabeth knew that marriage can often lead to a female ruler's undoing. By marrying and committing to an alliance with one party or nation, the queen becomes embroiled in conflicts that are not of her choosing, conflicts which may eventually overwhelm her or lead her into a feudal war. Also, the husband becomes the de facto ruler and often tries to do away with his wife, the queen, as Darnley tried to get rid of Mary. Elizabeth learned the lesson well. She had two goals as a ruler, to avoid marriage and to avoid war. She managed to combine these goals by dangling the possibility of marriage in order to forge alliances. The moment she committed to any single suitor would have been the moment she lost her power. She had to emanate mystery and desirability, never discouraging anyone's hopes, but never yielding. Throughout this lifelong game of flirting and withdrawing, Elizabeth dominated the country, and every man who sought to conquer her. As the center of attention, she was in control. Keeping her independence above all, Elizabeth protected her power and made herself an object of worship. As she said, "I would rather be a beggar and single than a queen and married." Keys to power. Since power depends greatly on appearances, you must learn the tricks that will enhance your image. Refusing to commit to a person or group is one of these. When you hold yourself back, you incur not anger, but a kind of respect. You instantly seem powerful because you make yourself ungraspable, rather than succumbing to the group or to the relationship as most people do. This aura of power only grows with time. As your reputation for independence grows, more and more people will come to desire you, wanting to be the one who gets you to commit. Desire is like a virus. If we see that someone is desired by other people, we tend to find this person desirable too. The moment you commit, the magic is gone. You become like everyone else. People will try all kinds of underhanded methods to get you to commit. They will give you gifts, shower you with favors, all to put you under obligation. Encourage the attention, stimulate their interest, but do not commit at any cost. Accept the gifts and favors if you so desire, but be careful to maintain your inner aloofness. You cannot inadvertently allow yourself to feel obligated to anyone. Remember, though, the goal is not to put people off or to make it seem that you are incapable of commitment. Like the Virgin Queen, you need to stir the pot, excite interest, lure people with the possibility of having you. You have to bend to their attention occasionally, but never too far. The Greek soldier and statesman Alcibiades played this game to perfection. It was Alcibiades who inspired and led the massive Athenian armada that invaded Sicily in 414 BC. When envious Athenians back home tried to bring him down by accusing him of trumped-up charges, he defected to the enemy, the Spartans, instead of facing a trial back home. Then after the Athenians were defeated at Syracuse, he left Sparta for Persia, even though the power of Sparta was now on the rise. Now, however, both the Athenians and the Spartans courted Alcibiades because of his influence with the Persians. And the Persians showered him with honors because of his power over the Athenians and the Spartans. He made promises to every side, but committed to none. And in the end, he held all the cards. If you aspire to power and influence, try the Alcibiades tactic. Put yourself in the middle between competing powers. Lure one side with a promise of your help. The other side, always wanting to outdo its enemy, will pursue you as well. As each side vies for your attention, you will immediately seem a person of great influence and desirability. More power will accrue to you than if you had rashly committed to one side. To perfect this tactic, you need to keep yourself inwardly free from emotional entanglements. And to view all those around you as pawns in your rise to the top. You cannot let yourself become the lackey for any cause. In the midst of the 1968 U.S. presidential election, Henry Kissinger made a phone call to Richard Nixon's team. Kissinger had been allied with Nelson Rockefeller, who had unsuccessfully sought the Republican nomination. Now Kissinger offered to supply the Nixon camp with valuable inside information on the negotiations for peace in Vietnam that were then going on in Paris. He had a man on the negotiating team keeping him informed of the latest developments. The Nixon team gladly accepted his offer. At the same time, however, Kissinger also approached the Democratic nominee, Hubert Humphrey, and offered his aid. The Humphrey people asked him for inside information on Nixon, and he supplied it. "Look," Kissinger told Humphrey's people, "I've hated Nixon for years." In fact, he had no interest on either side. What he really wanted was what he got, the promise of a high-level cabinet post from both Nixon and Humphrey. Whichever man won the election, Kissinger's career was secure. The winner, of course, was Nixon, and Kissinger duly went on to his cabinet post. Even so, he was careful never to appear too much of a Nixon man. When Nixon was re-elected in 1972, men much more loyal to him than Kissinger were fired. Kissinger was also the only Nixon high official to survive Watergate and serve under the next president, Gerald Ford. By maintaining a little distance, he thrived in turbulent times. Those who use this strategy often notice a strange phenomenon. People who rush to the support of others tend to gain little respect in the process, for their help is so easily obtained, while those who stand back find themselves besieged with supplicants. Their aloofness is powerful, and everyone wants them on their side. When Picasso, after early years of poverty, had become the most successful artist in the world, he didn't commit himself to this dealer or that dealer, although they now besieged him from all sides with attractive offers and grand promises. Instead, he appeared to have no interest in their services. This technique drove them wild, and as they fought over him, his prices only rose. When Henry Kissinger, as U.S. Secretary of State, wanted to reach détente with the Soviet Union, he made no concessions or conciliatory gestures, but courted China instead. This infuriated and also scared the Soviets. They were already politically isolated and feared further isolation if the United States and China came together. Kissinger's move pushed them to the negotiating table. The tactic has a parallel in seduction. When you want to seduce a woman, Stendhal advises, court her sister first. Stay aloof, and people will come to you. It will become a challenge for them to win your affections. As long as you imitate the wise virgin queen and stimulate their hopes, you will remain a magnet of attention and desire. Part 2. Do not commit to anyone. Stay above the fray. Do not let people drag you into their petty fights and squabbles. Seem interested and supportive, but find a way to remain neutral. Let others do the fighting while you stand back, watch, and wait. When the fighting parties are good and tired, they will be ripe for the picking. You can make it a practice, in fact, to stir up quarrels between other people, and then offer to mediate, gaining power as the go-between. Observance of the law. In the late 15th century, the strongest city-states in Italy, Venice, Florence, Rome, and Milan, found themselves constantly squabbling. Hovering above their struggles were the nations of France and Spain, ready to grab whatever they could from the weakened Italian powers. And trapped in the middle was the small state of Mantua, ruled by the young Duke Gianfrancesco Gonzaga. Mantua was strategically located in northern Italy, and it seemed only a matter of time before one of the powers swallowed it up, and it ceased to exist as an independent kingdom. Gonzaga was a fierce warrior and a skilled commander of troops, and he became a kind of mercenary general for whatever side paid him best. In the year 1490, he married Isabella d'Este, daughter of the ruler of another small Italian duchy, Ferrara. Since he now spent most of his time away from Mantua, it fell to Isabella to rule in his stead. Isabella's first true test as a ruler came in 1498, when King Louis XII of France was preparing armies to attack Milan. In their usual perfidious fashion, the Italian states immediately looked for ways to profit from Milan's difficulties. Pope Alexander VI promised not to intervene, thereby giving the French carte blanche. The Venetians signaled that they would not help Milan either, and in exchange for this, they hoped the French would give them Mantua. The ruler of Milan, Lodovico Sforza, suddenly found himself alone and abandoned. He turned to Isabella d'Este, one of his closest friends, also rumored to be his lover, and begged her to persuade Duke Gonzaga to come to his aid. Isabella tried, but her husband balked, for he saw Sforza's cause as hopeless. And so, in 1499, Louis swooped down on Milan and took it with ease. Isabella now faced a dilemma. If she stayed loyal to Lodovico, the French would now move against her. But if instead she allied herself with France, she would make enemies elsewhere in Italy, compromising Mantua once Louis eventually withdrew. And if she looked to Venice or Rome for help, they would simply swallow up Mantua under the cloak of coming to her aid. Yet she had to do something. The mighty king of France was breathing down her neck. She decided to befriend him, as she had befriended Lodovico Sforza before him, with alluring gifts, witty, intelligent letters, and the possibility of her company, for Isabella was famous as a woman of incomparable beauty and charm. In 1500, Louis invited Isabella to a great party in Milan to celebrate his victory. Leonardo da Vinci built an enormous mechanical lion for the affair. When the lion opened its mouth, it spewed fresh lilies, the symbols of French royalty. At the party, Isabella wore one of her celebrated dresses. She had by far the largest wardrobe of any of the Italian princesses. And just as she had hoped, she charmed and captivated Louis, who ignored all the other ladies vying for his attention. She soon became his constant companion, and in exchange for her friendship, he pledged to protect Mantua's independence from Venice. As one danger receded, however, another, more worrying one arose, this time from the south in the form of Cesare Borgia. Starting in 1500, Borgia had marched steadily northward, gobbling up all the small kingdoms in his path in the name of his father, Pope Alexander. Isabella understood Cesare perfectly. He could be neither trusted nor in any way offended. He had to be cajoled and kept at arm's length. Isabella began by sending him gifts, falcons, prize dogs, perfumes, and dozens of masks, which he knew he always wore when he walked the streets of Rome. She sent messengers with flattering greetings, although these messengers also acted as her spies. At one point, Cesare asked if he could house some troops in Mantua. Isabella managed to dissuade him politely, knowing full well that once the troops were quartered in the city, they would never leave. Even while Isabella was charming Cesare, she convinced everyone around her to take care, never to utter a harsh word about him, since he had spies everywhere and would use the slightest pretext for invasion. When Isabella had a child, she asked Cesare to be the godfather. She even dangled in front of him the possibility of a marriage between her family and his. Somehow it all worked, for although elsewhere he seized everything in his path, he spared Mantua. In 1503, Cesare's father, Alexander, died, and a few years later the new pope, Julius II, went to war to drive the French troops from Italy. When the ruler of Ferrara, Alfonso, Isabella's brother, sided with the French, Julius decided to attack and humble him. Once again, Isabella found herself in the middle, the pope on one side, the French and her brother on the other. She dared not ally herself with either, but to offend either would be equally disastrous. Again, she played the double game at which she had become so expert. On the one hand, she got her husband Gonzaga to fight for the pope, knowing he would not fight very hard. On the other, she let French troops pass through Mantua to come to Ferrara's aid. While she publicly complained that the French had invaded her territory, she privately supplied them with valuable information. To make the invasion plausible to Julius, she even had the French pretend to plunder Mantua. It worked once again. The pope left Mantua alone. In 1513, after a lengthy siege, Julius defeated Ferrara, and the French troops withdrew. Worn out by the effort, the Pope died a few months later. With his death, the nightmarish cycle of battles and petty squabbles began to repeat itself. A great deal changed in Italy during Isabella's reign. Popes came and went. Cesare Borgia rose and then fell. Venice lost its empire. Milan was invaded. Florence fell into decline, and Rome was sacked by the Habsburg Emperor Charles V. Through all this, tiny Mantua not only survived, but thrived. Its court the envy of Italy. Its wealth and sovereignty would remain intact for a century after Isabella's death in 1539. Interpretation. Isabella d'Este understood Italy's political situation with amazing clarity. Once you took the side of any of the forces on the field, you were doomed. The powerful would take you over, the weak would wear you down. Any new alliance would lead to a new enemy. And as this cycle stirred up more conflict, other forces would be dragged in until you could no longer extricate yourself. Eventually, you would collapse from exhaustion. Isabella steered her kingdom on the only course that would bring her safely through. She wouldn't allow herself to lose her head through loyalty to a duke or a king. Nor would she try to stop the conflict that raged around her. That would only drag her into it. And in any case, the conflict was to her advantage. If the various parties were fighting to the death and exhausting themselves in the process, they were in no position to gobble up Mantua. The source of Isabella's power was her clever ability to seem interested in the affairs and interests of each side, while actually committing to no one but herself and her kingdom. Once you step into a fight that is not of your own choosing, you lose all initiative. The combatants' interests become your interests. You become their tool. Learn to control yourself, to restrain your natural tendency to take sides and join the fight. Be friendly and charming to each of the combatants, then step back as they collide. With every battle, they grow weaker, while you grow stronger with every battle you avoid. An ancient Chinese saying, when the snipe and the mussel struggle, the fisherman gets the benefit. Keys to power. To succeed in the game of power, you have to master your emotions. But even if you succeed in gaining such self-control, you can never control the temperamental dispositions of those around you. And this presents a great danger. Most people operate in a whirlpool of emotions, constantly reacting, churning up squabbles and conflicts. Your self-control and autonomy will only bother and infuriate them. They will try to draw you into the whirlpool, begging you to take sides in their endless battles, or to make peace for them. If you succumb to their emotional entreaties, little by little you will find your mind and time occupied by their problems. Do not allow whatever compassion and pity you possess to suck you in. You can never win in this game. The conflicts can only multiply. On the other hand, you cannot completely stand aside, for that would cause needless offense. To play the game properly, you must seem interested in other people's problems, even sometimes appear to take their side. But while you make outward gestures of support, you must maintain your inner energy and sanity by keeping your emotions disengaged. No matter how hard people try to pull you in, never let your interest in their affairs and petty squabbles go beyond the surface. Give them gifts. Listen with a sympathetic look. Even occasionally play the charmer. But inwardly keep both the friendly kings and the perfidious Borgias at arm's length. By refusing to commit and thus maintaining your autonomy, you retain the initiative. Your moves stay matters of your own choosing, not defensive reactions to the push and pull of those around you. Slowness to pick up your weapons can be a weapon in itself, especially if you let other people exhaust themselves fighting, then take advantage of their exhaustion. In ancient China, the kingdom of Qin once invaded the kingdom of Xing. Huan, the ruler of a nearby province, thought he should rush to Xing's defense, but his advisor counseled him to wait. "Xing is not yet going to ruin," he said, "and Xin is not yet exhausted. If Qin is not exhausted, we cannot become very influential. Moreover, the merit of supporting a state in danger is not as great as the virtue of reviving a ruined one." The advisor's argument won the day, And as he had predicted, Juan later had the glory both of rescuing Xing from the brink of destruction and then of conquering an exhausted Qin. He stayed out of the fighting until the forces engaged in it had worn each other down, at which point it was safe for him to intervene. That is what holding back from the fray allows you. Time to position yourself to take advantage of the situation once one side starts to lose. You can also take the game a step further by promising your support to both sides in a conflict, while maneuvering so that the one to come out ahead in the struggle is you. This was what Castruccio Castracani, ruler of the Italian town of Lucca in the 14th century, did when he had designs on the town of Pistoia. A siege would have been expensive, costing both lives and money. But Castruccio knew that Pistoia contained two rival factions, the blacks and the whites, which hated one another. He negotiated with the blacks, promising to help them against the whites. Then, without their knowledge, he promised the whites he would help them against the blacks. And Castruccio kept his promises. He sent an army to a black-controlled gate of the city, which the sentries, of course, welcomed in. Meanwhile, another of his armies entered through a white-controlled gate. The two armies, united in the middle, occupied the town, killed the leaders of both factions, ended the internal war, and took Pistoia for Castruccio. Preserving your autonomy gives you options when people come to blows. You can play the mediator, broker the peace, while really securing your own interests. You can pledge support to one side, and the other may have to court you with a higher bid. Or, like Castruccio, you can appear to take both sides, then play the antagonists against each other. Oftentimes when a conflict breaks out, you are tempted to side with the stronger party, or the one that offers you apparent advantages in an alliance. This is risky business. First, it is often difficult to foresee which side will prevail in the long run. But even if you guess right and ally yourself with the stronger party, you may find yourself swallowed up and lost, or conveniently forgotten when they become victors. Side with the weaker, on the other hand, and you are doomed. But play a waiting game, and you cannot lose. In France's July Revolution of 1830, after 3 days of riots, the statesman Talleyrand, now elderly, sat by his Paris window, listening to the pealing bells that signaled the riots were over. Turning to an assistant, he said, "Ah, the bells. We're winning." "Who's we, mon prince?" the assistant asked. Gesturing for the man to keep quiet, Talleyrand replied, "Not a word. I'll tell you who we are tomorrow." He well knew that only fools rush into a situation, that by committing too quickly, you lose your maneuverability. People also respect you less. Perhaps tomorrow they think you will commit to another, different cause, since you gave yourself so easily to this one. Good fortune is a fickle god, and will often pass from one side to the other. Commitment to one side deprives you of the advantage of time and the luxury of waiting. Let others fall in love with this group or that. For your part, don't rush in. Don't lose your head. Finally, there are occasions when it is wisest to drop all pretense of appearing supportive, and instead to trumpet your independence and self-reliance. The aristocratic pose of independence is particularly important for those who need to gain respect. George Washington recognized this in his work to establish the young American Republic on firm ground. As president, Washington avoided the temptation of making an alliance with France or England, despite the pressure on him to do so. He wanted the country to earn the world's respect through its independence. Although a treaty with France might have helped in the short term, in the long run he knew it would be more effective to establish the nation's autonomy. Europe would have to see the United States as an equal power. Remember, you have only so much energy and so much time. Every moment wasted on the affairs of others subtracts from your strength. You may be afraid that people will condemn you as heartless, but in the end, maintaining your independence and self-reliance will gain you more respect and place you in a position of power, from which you can choose to help others on your own initiative. Reversal. Both parts of this law will turn against you if you take it too far. The game proposed here is delicate and difficult. If you play too many parties against one another, they will see through the maneuver and will gang up on you. If you keep your growing number of suitors waiting too long, you will inspire not desire,